Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, coming to you on Tuesday instead of Thursday this week. Have a lot of things happening this coming Thursday, and so had to make some adjustments. I hope that that didn't throw your schedule off, because I know you're committed to meeting my program at a certain time. It's just for this week, and next week we'll be back on track. And by the way, next week is vacation time for me. I am so going to look forward and so going to enjoy that time, but I will still be here on Blog Talk. It's my pleasure to come to you every Monday and Thursday on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Today I have a very, very challenging and important topic. You know, in just about 6 days, the Sunni Muslims, that's the largest group of Muslims in the world compared to the Shias in Iran, will begin their worldwide month-long Ramadan fast. Shias also participate, and it's actually all Muslims together. I'm just showing the differences between the two distinct groups. But this is a very important time for Muslims, especially at this time, because according to their understanding and teaching, it was at this time that in their theology, Muhammad received the revelation of the Quran. And so it's a month-long time of fasting and praying, reading the Quran, preparing themselves for the Day of Judgment, getting rid of those things in their lives that are they call sin. And so at this time of a Muslim's life, they are very spiritually in tune. It may be that all the rest of the years they're not reading the Quran as they should, they're not really praying as they should, but it's at this time, it's their duty, it's their ritual to begin praying and to begin fasting and to begin reading. And it's at this time that we as Christians have a golden opportunity to really pray that God will speak to their hearts about Jesus during Ramadan. In fact, there is an agency, an organization, worldchristian.com, that prepares a 30-day guide of praying for Muslims all over the world. This is an amazing opportunity, if you've never done it before, to pray sincerely for Muslims to come to Christ. And Ramadan is that time that I believe God will use when they're so spiritually sensitive and fasting, and that God will use our effectual, faithful praying to open their eyes. Now, if you somehow doubt in any way that God will do that, the two sound bites I'm going to play for you should change your mind forever. Because literally, all over the world, God is doing an amazing work of grace in the hearts of Muslims through dreams and visions. There is a book by Tom Doyle called Dreams and Visions. Is Jesus Awakening the Muslim World? Indeed, he's doing that. In fact, the Bible teaches us in Acts chapter 2, as Peter is giving his great Pentecostal sermon from the prophet Joel, he says, "In the last days, God says, I will pour out my spirit upon all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions, and your old men will dream dreams. In those days, I will pour out my spirit even on my servants, men and women alike, and they will prophesy." In this great Pentecostal sermon, as Peter is quoting from Joel, talking about the coming of the Spirit, he mentions dreams and visions, and this is what God is doing in the many countries that are closed down to the gospel. God is doing this specific work in the hearts of Muslims, giving them supernatural dreams and visions. And as you're going to hear right now in this report, he is faithful to bring many Muslims to Christ. We're going to hear this special report right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Despite the barbaric acts of ISIS, there is still hope for those living in the world of Islam. Recently, our Chris Mitchell met with Christians in Kurdistan who shared amazing stories of supernatural encounters with Jesus happening throughout the Middle East.
As ISIS conquered parts of northern Iraq and persecuted Christian minorities, as Iran continues to suppress religious freedom, a surprising result happened. The gospel actually began to spread.
So besides the darkness coming in and trying to get the light and salt out, killing lives and bringing so much pain and suffering, on the other hand, we're seeing a rise of the presence of God, worship, prayer, people experiencing Jesus, and people open up to the gospel and coming to know him and follow him, even from Muslim background.
Fabian leads a house of prayer in Kurdistan. He told us of meeting people who had supernatural encounters with Jesus.
People in these streets and in these refugee camps from places where ISIS have occupied, even people from here, that are encountering Jesus in dreams and visions.
Those divine encounters are not limited to ISIS-controlled areas. It's a phenomenon happening throughout the Middle East. CBN News met with some visiting Iranians to Kurdistan who wanted to share their stories. We've concealed their identities for their own protection.
One night when I was in bed, I had a dream, and the light was speaking as I'm speaking to you now. It was calling my name verbally and saying, "Come to me, I will save you and I will rescue you." But I didn't understand.
That decision soon followed for Abby and her mother.
About 7 months ago, we made our own decision to follow Jesus with all our heart. When we came here, they explained about the life of Christ and the kingdom of God according to the gospel. Here we realized that my dream was of Jesus. He is calling us to give us salvation and to give us rest, to give us life.
I asked what danger she faces back in Iran.
If people knew about my faith, I would be rejected. This is a type of social persecution. If the government knew about my faith, I would be executed or hung in the street at once.
Claire came to faith through scripture and a friend.
When I was reading the Bible, I couldn't ask others to explain the passage. When I went to university, I met an Armenian girl. I asked her so many questions. How did they live? How did they worship? Many things like that about the Christian life. Her answers brought me to make my own decision.
It changed her life.
Christ brought me many blessings. I can't describe how faithful Jesus has been. But things which I cannot say in words have happened to me. Whenever I am praying and I'm lifting up my spirit towards God, I do believe and I feel the hand of God touching my heart and shaking my heart.
This man, we'll call Dennis, also had a dream.
In the dream, I still remember some marks on his face and that he was wearing a crown, a king's crown, on his head. A strong brightness came out of each part of his body, and many people were bowing down before him. That dream is still alive in me, and it's with me every day. I remember feeling like I saw heaven. He showed me many different things since I believed in Jesus, but that dream became a turning point in my life.
I asked him if others are coming to Jesus inside Iran.
Yes, many people are coming to Christ through dreams. You can't imagine how Jesus is appearing to people. I feel like everybody's looking for a home, looking for the truth. What the Iranian people are going through right now is very difficult. The only one who can change that situation is Christ Himself. So please pray and ask others to pray for the people of Iran to experience the power of the resurrection.
Iran's mullahs try to quench Christianity in their Islamic Republic. Despite those efforts, missionaries say Iran has one of the fastest growing churches in the world. While politics and extremists rearrange the Middle East, Fabian and others say the Holy Spirit is working at a much higher level to change lives.
The harvest is very ripe and people are desperate. They have lost everything, they are in pain, they need help, and they are ready to listen, and people need to know that. Yes, there's many bad people and they want to kill and destroy, but there's so much more people who are desperate for answers in life. And we, as the light and salt, we need to be here for such a time as this, to be His voice and be His hand and bring the gospel of the kingdom to their lives.
Chris.
As I started investigating,
there you have it. It is an amazing, amazing story, but this is a consistent story among many Muslim men and women, how an appearance of Jesus in a dream or vision has so radically shook their foundation that they have left Islam to find the God of unconditional love and grace and peace. I want you to hear now from the author, Tom Doyle, as he shares his important stories that he used in writing his book, Dreams and Visions.
Despite all the turmoil, you suggest in your new book, Dreams and Visions, that God is really on the move in the Muslim community.
Yes.
How so?
Boy, it is a desperate time. And today, though, more Muslims have come to faith in Christ in the last 10 years than in the last 14 centuries of the religion. So it is a true harvest time. And, of course, the enemy knows that and wants to disrupt that.
Well, share one of your favorite stories from your book.
Okay, well, we were doing a medical clinic in Jordan, and there were a lot of Muslim people that were coming in,
mm-hmm.
and there was a woman that came in, and she had a problem with her shoulder,
right.
And so she spoke to the doctor and said, would you help me? He's an American doctor, and we kind of prep our team to make sure that they're not too outward with the gospel. They just have
sure.
to wait and see how it goes, and as soon as they sit down, she looks at the doctor, and she said, Mr. Jeff, are you a Christian? And he wasn't sure how to answer that at first. Of course he is, but he didn't want to blow the cover. Well, yes, I am. And here's this fully covered Muslim woman.
Right.
She pulls up one sleeve, pulls up another one. There was a tattoo of a cross on her forearm, and she said, I love Jesus.
Oh, my goodness.
He was shocked. He just stood there silent. Then he looked over at her husband, and he was sitting over by the side, and he waved and said, me too.
Me too.
They're a part of this underground church of these Muslims that now in Jordan are meeting in the middle of the night, worshiping Jesus. They've been set free.
Wow. Now, some Christians, a lot of Christians, fear Muslims, and for good reason.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about 9/11 and
all
the violence going on. You've traveled extensively throughout the Muslim world and the Middle East. What have you experienced?
You know, actually, we've seen quite the reverse. I mean, there's certain areas that you wouldn't go into, and of course, we're not looking for problems.
Right.
We're not trying to be stupid out there and go into areas that you shouldn't. But we found that most Muslims are very open to meeting Christians and like people from the West.
And I think that's surprising.
It
you
is.
Know, because what you see on the news says differently.
It's really true. And I think if the statistics are true that we've gathered from other mission organizations, we have come to know this, that about 60% of Muslims worldwide don't even practice. They don't practice their religion. 30% do practice their religion, but maybe 8%, let's round it off and say 10%, can be radical. So that's formidable,
yeah.
But really the bulk of the Muslims just aren't into jihad. They'd rather feed their kids and send them to a good school.
So why do you say that this is the decade for Muslims to come to Christ?
I think they are desperate. And after 9/11, every Muslim worldwide had to ask themselves one question. Is this what it means to be a good Muslim? Do I have to go out and kill people? Do I have to go out and kill infidels? The majority of them don't want to do that. A woman in the Gaza Strip grabbed my arm once and said, "You're from America." And did you see the buildings coming down and people cheering in Gaza? Mm. She was all covered. And I said, "Well, yes, I did." And she said, "Well, not me. Mm. I was crying for those people. They didn't deserve to die. And that was wrong." And she turned and walked away. And so,
well, what can Christians do, Tom, right now for the Muslim community?
Well, you know, I think the first thing we have to do is confess our prejudice and realize that not every one of them is out to blow up America and take us down. But really, we need to pray for them. This is the gospel that we've been given the charge to go to the ends of the earth. One-fifth of the globe is Muslim. Soon will be one-fourth. They need Jesus. And I think Satan's strategy is to get us to be afraid of them or hate them,
yeah.
And fear and hatred would both be unbiblical positions, but if we're afraid of them or hate them, we won't take Jesus to them.
Mm.
And so he wins in that. So I would say pray. Pray for Muslims. Pray for them around the world. If Muslims move into your neighborhood, don't be afraid of them. Don't pick up the phone and call 911. You know? Go over and meet them. You'll be surprised. Have them over for dinner.
Well, Jesus isn't afraid of them. And in fact, he's appearing to them in dreams. That's how much
amazing.
He loves them. In his heart is that none should perish, right?
That's exactly right. And the gospel will bust through the gates of hell. It will go anywhere. And about half Muslims we're meeting now that come to faith in Jesus say, it all started with a dream.
Tom, dreams and visions. His new book is Jesus Awakening the Muslim World. You can get this at bookstores anywhere now.
Anywhere.
Anywhere,
yeah.
Or online. We'll put a link on our website. So, Tom, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you. God bless you.
Special CBN report with an amazing man who has an incredible love for the Muslim people. I agree with everything he just said. Not all Muslims are radical. Most of them absolutely condemn the attacks on 9/11. And most of them are hungry and thirsty for truth, for righteousness, for meaning and purpose. Most of them are not practicing. Excuse me. This is a golden opportunity for you and me to reach out in love and bring them the good news of the gospel. I do this on my Facebook in so many ways, but I have a particular page called Tears in a Bottle, Seeing Through Their Eyes. This is a book I wrote about a friendship between a Muslim woman and a Christian woman several years ago, and it's still one of my favorite books to promote simply because it is filled with love and compassion for Muslims, and it disarms the idea that every one of these Muslims are radical or involved in terrorism. This book sets the record straight, as Tom Doyle so rightly said, and he's been all over the world, and he has talked to Muslims who secretly worship Christ, who are coming out of Islam, but for fear of their own life, they have to be very careful. And Tom Doyle is recording the dreams and visions that God is using in their heart. We need to really be sensitive to the Holy Spirit and reach out to Muslims with the love and grace of God they so desperately need. And now is the time, as Ramadan approaches on June 6th, that we prepare our hearts to pray for them, to reach out to them, because God wants to save them and reveal Jesus to them. I want to talk to you this morning about a young Christian girl, 35 years old, who is in very serious health in Iran. Her name is Miriam Naghash Zagaran, and she is being kept in the women's ward in Evin prison. That's ward 209, where there's torture and rape. And her life is in grave danger because just being in that ward. But she started a hunger strike back on May 26th, and the reason that Miriam did that is to protest the systematic violence and the abuse of her basic rights, such as no medical care, a conditional release, and just no escape from prison. And because of that, she has been recently transferred to the hospital because her physical condition is deteriorating. And Now, because of no medical treatment and the fast, she has become unconscious. And I've seen a picture of her with IVs in her arm. Her petition is up on my page, and I want to tell you a little bit more about her, but I urge you to sign this petition. There needs to be a ton of signatures so that we get the eye and the ear of the Iranian government. Miriam is 35. She suffers from atrial septal defect, which is ASD, diabetes, blood fat, severe pain in her ears, and chronic dizziness. Now, just if that's just the tip of the iceberg. She's also contracted lumbar disc arthritis and anemia because of poor nutrition and inappropriate conditions in prison. Intelligence service officials summoned Miriam in 2013. That's 3 years ago, and she was taken to Evin prison. And since then, she has endured several tortures, both physically and mentally. And they have kept her in isolation where she doesn't have access to sanitary facilities. And of course, as they do with all Christians, Iran's authorities accuse her on propaganda against the regime. And they accuse her of acting against national security. And they have set her bail till it's impossible for her to get out. At one point, she managed through some friends to have 19 days of freedom, but then she was rearrested and now sentenced to 4 years in prison on these same ambiguous charges. And this goes on and on for all Christians in Iran, especially those like Miriam who can be put to death because they've changed their religion from Islam to Christianity. What I want you to do is pray for Miriam. That is central to everything we do here on the Cross in the Desert. It is supporting our Iranian friends in prayer and fasting as the Lord leads you. And as you begin to pray, I just hope that your prayer vision includes the thousands of Christians who are in prison, those that are suffering because of their faith, those that are meeting secretly in the house church movement. And as you pray, think about the signatures that God can use on this petition and to get the attention of the Iranian government, because petitions don't always work, but they do work at times. But we have to bathe these petitions in signatures and prayers. On my Facebook page, you're going to see a picture of a young lady. Her name is Sima. She's a wonderful Iranian person who is standing up with a picture of Miriam. She's my Facebook friend. She is an Iranian lady who lives in Canada. She is a strong human rights lady. You'll see her picture, and then you'll see a link to the petition. As you scroll down my page, you'll also see a picture of poor Miriam in a hospital bed. I just pray that God will move on your heart to put her on your continuous prayer list because she desperately needs medical attention. And without adequate medical attention, she will die. So I just pray, first of all, that you would go to my Facebook page and you'll see the petitions. I ask you to not only sign these petitions, but to share them to as many of your friends as possible. Let's get this petition circulated everywhere. And as you do that, you'll also see a petition for Sima Babi, who is an Iranian human rights activist that was recently arrested. Share her petition with all of your friends. Let's make as much effort as we have time for to share, to pray, to speak out for these suffering Iranian people who desperately need hope and freedom, because that's what my program is all about. I thank you so much for letting me talk to you about this, and please let's get involved and make a difference. As I've been speaking about dreams and visions, Muslims come to Christ because they see God as a God of unconditional love and mercy and passion and compassion. This is a song that fits what I'm saying this morning and talking to you about. It's by Misty Edwards. It's about that grip that God has on the heart of the unbeliever, that unconditional love, and he won't relent. This is Misty Edwards on the Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
All my heart is yours.
That is the powerful, prophetic music of Misty Edwards, a song called You Won't Relent. We're going to transition now on the cross in the desert. I want to begin reading today from my book, Rehane, A Beautiful Fragrance. We're going to be beginning in chapter 9, right after this important song, which is the introduction to my reading. That is the fairy tale theme from the Disney movie Shrek. And it's an appropriate song that will begin our reading today from Rehane, A Beautiful Fragrance. We're beginning chapter 9, and right before chapter 9 is something called Rehane, Reflections on Rehane. And this comes from my dear friend Zara, an Iranian student who lives in Italy right now and is working on her degree. She writes, "Having defended herself, she ended up murdering a human being. But was he really a human being? When I heard about what happened to her, I was really upset. All of the evidence was against her innocence, and sadly she was unable to prove that she only tried to defend herself. I was hopeful that this man's family would forgive her, even though the law refused to. In the end, sorrowfully, they didn't forgive her, and she had to taste the bitterness of revenge. A lot of thoughts came to my head. If only they had forgiven her. If only she had never met this man. If only the law was more supportive for women. If only, unfortunately, all of her plans in life turned into ashes. All of her beautiful dreams never came true. She could not taste the flavor of happiness. She could not experience love. She could not feel the joy of being as mom. Rehane is a symbol of patience and hope. She fought until the very last moment of her life to defend her right to stay alive. She is one example of millions of women who are suffering from injustice, inequalities, brutality, and many artifacts in the law. May she rest in peace. I look forward to the day in my beloved country when men and women have equal rights and women will not be punished for defending themselves from some savages. Zahra, an Iranian student studying abroad in Italy. I just want to take a moment to reflect on exactly what Zahra said. If you listened carefully, this was so well thought out. She articulated her position so well. And the way she described this, I'm so glad that Zahra sent this to me. What a wonderful tribute to Rehani. If you have your book, we are beginning now the reading of chapter 9. It's entitled The Trial. Rehani wiped the sweat from underneath her black Magna Hay scarf that tightly covered her head, neck, and shoulders. Today was Saturday, December 13th, 2008, the opening session of her trial. Her soul was tormented by both fear and anxiety. Today, she felt like a lamb being led to the slaughter. Besides the black scarf, Rehani also was wearing a dark blue chador, decorated with tiny white flowers, a pair of neatly pressed black slacks and soft slippers to keep her feet comfortable for a very long day. The trial was being held in Branch 74, Tehran Province Criminal Court, with Judge Kumakarai presiding. Rehani was being represented by her lawyer, Mr. Mohammed Mustafa. Mr. Mustafa began the first session by objecting to the prosecution's failure to allow him and his assistants to accurately study the case file. The judge dismissed the motion and instead called for the first session to officially begin. Prior to the first day of the trial, the prosecution had engaged in unethical tactics of portraying Rehani as an immoral woman. They had subpoenaed several people, including the head of the advertising firm where she worked and her fiancé, to participate in lengthy interrogations conducted by Shamlou. It was during this lengthy interrogation that the individuals were coerced into confessing that they were all involved in illicit sexual relationships with Rehani. The prosecution intended to prove that Rehani was a disturbed and immoral woman that stabbed Dr. Sorbandi and then later changed her version of the crime to a rape defense. The prosecution launched into their case with the basic assertion that Rehani committed premeditated murder and tried to cover up her crime by pleading self-defense. Quote, the defendant confessed to having purchased a knife in advance, proving that this was a premeditated crime, the prosecution argued. The police discovered a bloodied headscarf and a knife in her home. However, what the prosecution failed to disclose was that Rehani confessed to purchasing a knife only after interrogators threatened to harm her sister. The confession was therefore coerced. Evidence that the door to the empty room was not locked but was left open proves that Sorbandi was not trying to rape Rehani, the prosecution proclaimed. The defendant also fled the scene pursued by the victim. This demonstrates her guilt. At one point in the trial, the deceased's son, Jalal Sorbandi, was being questioned by Judge Kukumarai. The judge questioned Sarbandi's ethical reasoning as a Muslim, arguing that a good Muslim man would not have allowed himself to be alone with another unmarried woman. And based on his conclusion, the judge urged the court to engage in a more detailed investigation. Outraged by the judge's assertion, the prosecution objected to his conclusion, and very soon after his remarks, the judge was replaced by Judge Tardast. Judge Tardast focused solely on the character of Rehani and ignored any evidence that would link Sorbandi to a rape charge. Sorbandi's cell phone calls and text messages to Rehani were ignored. Instead, Judge Tardast concluded that Rehani was not having a business relationship with Sorbandi, but a sexual one. Collecting the so-called confessions of her boss and fiancé, Tardast asserted that Rehani's motive for murder was revenge because Sorbandi didn't lend her his car and take her on trips to Europe as he promised. Tardast alleged that since his fatal stab wound was from behind, that Rehani became angry at him while he was praying and stabbed him in the back. Rahane's assertion that a Mr. Shecky was coming through the door into the flat as she was leaving was never investigated. There was no attempt to ever find or locate Mr. Shecky to investigate his connection to the crime. One of Rahane's statements in court, in that she said, quote, "I gave service to Sir Bondi, he in return gave service to me," was twisted and construed as a sexual statement that proved they were both engaged in a sexual relationship. Also, one of Rahane's text messages that supposedly said, "I think I will kill him tonight," implied that she was planning the murder. However, Judge Tardash interpreted the SMS message as a reference to Rahane's father, and he refused to allow testimony to explain the context of the text message. During exams week, Rahane's girlfriends were urging her to go out with them. She replied that her father would not let her out of the house to socialize until the exams were finished. Rahane became frustrated with her father's decision and texted them saying, quote, "I think I will kill him tonight." The text message was not meant to be understood as a premeditated plot to killing her father, but rather a moment of frustration and anger for not being allowed to socialize during exam time. Judge Tardash tried to use this text message to portray Rahane as a cold-blooded killer who could not control her anger and would later kill her lover, Dr. Sir Bondi. Judge Tardash claimed to have carefully examined every detail of the crime and concluded that Rahane had, quote, "an unstable, narcissistic personality and an abnormal relationship with her family." Therefore, Rahane was guilty of the premeditated murder of Morteza Sir Bondi. In response to the conclusions of the prosecution's case, the defense complained that the entire proceedings were unfair and lacking in due process. From day one, Rahane claimed the stabbing was in self-defense, but the judge refused to believe her, implying that she was a liar. The defense argued that Rahane never purchased a knife but was forced to confess under torture in order to protect her sister. The defense pointed out that Sir Bondi had purchased condoms and pills before they arrived at the flat, demonstrating a plan to seduce and rape Rahane. However, the judge argued that this instead showed an ongoing sexual relationship. Even though the drug diphenoxate was discovered in one of the juice classes, yet the prosecution instead focused on only one of the uses of the drug as a laxative instead of its main purpose as a sedative. The front door was locked. Rahane struggled to open it using her knife and was only able to escape when Mr. Shecky suddenly arrived to open it, the defense pointed out. There was a vacant room, a condom, pills, a sheet on the sofa, a demand by Sir Bondi to remove her headscarf, a physical embrace, and a threat by the deceased that there is no way of escape. This all points to rape, and demanded that Rahane must resort to self-defense in order to save herself, the defense argued. Rahane's lawyers were quick to point out that unlike a real murderer, she did not engage in trying to destroy the evidence. She did not hide the knife and headscarf, but took them home. Concerning the SMS text messages, she did not destroy that evidence, but instead left them on her phone. A real murderer would leave the scene hastily, yet Rahane did not, but instead called an ambulance for Sir Bondi and waited for their arrival. They also argued that Jalal Sir Bondi himself admitted that Rahane may not be the murderer and pointed out she was not strong enough to kill his father. Finally, the defense confronted the bias of the court and accused them of allowing Sir Bondi's reputation as a former intelligent agent influence the outcome of their decision. After six intense and rigorous sessions, the defense finally rested, and Rahane's life now hung in the balance, awaiting the decision of the judge. April 2009, just a few weeks after the Persian New Year, when Iranians looked forward to a new beginning of hope and freedom, Rahane's worst fears were realized. Judge Tardash charged Rahane with first-degree murder and sentenced her to death by hanging. Rahane would face the harsh consequences of gesis, the law of retribution, or an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Gesis is a Sharia class of crime. The victim is entitled to retribution. The victim's family would participate in carrying out the verdict And in Rouhani's case, they would remove or kick the chair out from underneath her, resulting in her being hanged. Under the Gesis law, the family can decide to forgive and show mercy. If they did decide to forgive, Rouhani's family would have to pay dia, a large sum of blood money, to compensate them for the victim's death. The news of the death sentence devastated Rouhani. Judge Tardash claimed that her case had been scrutinized and analyzed by five other judges, cross-checked by 13 Supreme Court judges, and they had all come to the same conclusions. In her mind, Rouhani realized that she had been the victim of a well-organized plot to destroy her reputation and save the image of the Sarbandi family. Instead of being vindicated as a victim of rape, instead she was now being punished like a cold-blooded killer. For Rouhani, the Persian New Year of 2009 was not an occasion of hope and new beginnings, but instead an agonizing waiting game that led to a dawn execution with a rope around her neck. Rouhani returned back to the cell in Evin. Lying on her back, she stared up hopelessly at the ceiling and could hear the voice of her father. "Be strong. Don't forget you are Kurdish." Rouhani closed her eyes. Deep down inside, she could feel the Kurdish spirit rising up in the darkness of her soul. At that moment, she was determined to make her voice known to the world and the truth of what really happened to her on the hot summer day in 2007. I want to pause right there as we finish chapter 9. And instead of reading on, I want to talk about this with you a little bit. Usually I will read for an entire half an hour, but I think it's a good time right here to stop at chapter 9. And I want to talk to you about this chapter. There is no justice for the accused in Iran. As you could hear what happened at this trial, and there are photographs all over the internet of Rouhani with her hands raised, pleading, reasoning with the judge. You can see photographs of her in court wearing her blue Manitou or black Manitou with the tiny flowers. And some of these pictures are in my book, Rouhani, A Beautiful Fragrance. But you see, the only way that they can punish Rouhani and silence her is to destroy her reputation. This is the plight of a Muslim woman under Sharia law. Under Sharia law, a case of rape has to be proved by four male eyewitnesses. What an obscene law that is. What an unjust law that is. And as I've read this book to you, you understand the context that Rouhani grew up in, the context of other young women. Atifi, back in 2000, I think in 2004, where she was in a situation where this man, quite older than her, was sexually abusing her. And at one point in time, she woke up and said, "I've had enough of this," and wanted to report this as rape. But as you understand, in her case, they took the side of this former Revolutionary Guard member. And instead accused of this girl of being wanton, of being sexually promiscuous. And in the end, when she tried to prove her case of rape, she became frustrated. That is Atifi. And at one point in Necca, Iran, this is where she just removed her hijab in protest against this law. And the judge became angry. But then she picked up her shoe and threw it at the judge. And the judge himself, on the day of execution, participated in the hanging of Atifi. And then later on, there was another case of rape in which another young girl and her niece were walking in a park, and a gang of men tried to rape this young girl. And she defended herself by stabbing him, much like Rouhani. Her name was Nazanin. And a very famous human rights activist, Nazanin Afshinjam, heard about her case all the way from Canada, and took up the cause of putting pressure on the government, and through much cooperation from other human rights groups and money, together Nazanin was victorious in squelching this case, and this young girl, Nazanin, was also set free. an incredible, incredible move of God in that situation. Nazanin Afshin Jam was also involved in the number of petitions speaking out for Rouhani, 200,000 signatures. But you see what Rouhani was up against. The culture she grew up in is so opposed to the rights of women. And on the books, you see the cases of rape and how they were treated. The man is always vindicated, and the woman is more than just victimized. And she is accused of being immoral. She's accused of being a fornicator. And instead of being exonerated, then she is instead punished. Instead of being vindicated, I should say, she is instead being punished. This is the culture that Rouhani grew up in. It was shortly after Rouhani's death that there was a young girl named Farazaneh, I think is her name, who was a hotel worker in a city in Iran, and this Revolutionary Guard member was trying to rape her. And her way of escape was to leap from a window to her death. You see, because this young girl understood that trying to prove this case of rape, she knew there was no hope for her. And so she leapt to her death. Rouhani never took the easy way out. Rouhani stood strong and courageous. She never changed her story. To the very day of execution, and she continued to assert her innocence and claimed that this was in self-defense. Now, Rouhani knew the odds were so against her. She knew that there was no hope. But instead of confessing to what was a lie and somehow maybe escaping execution, instead of doing that, Rouhani stood in honor of being a woman and said to this evil system, "I know I will never survive this, but I will not lie to protect myself." I want you to think about that for a moment. Put yourself in her place. If you thought there was an opportunity, maybe even a slim one, that you could be spared from the noose, would you consider perhaps confessing to something that wasn't true? Would there be that temptation? I'm sure that thought might have crossed Rouhani's mind. I'm sure she thought about it. But Rouhani refused to give in to that temptation. She stood strong on her honor. This is why I call the book Rouhani, A Beautiful Fragrance. Honor, mercy, and compassion are the beautiful fragrances of Rouhani Jabari. I can imagine what it was like to hear those words from Judge Tardast, who did everything to smear her reputation. In fact, he did such a good job. I have a Facebook friend I won't mention, and she comes from a family of lawyers. And when she heard that I supported Rouhani, she says, "Randy, open your eyes. That girl murdered that man. It had nothing to do with self-defense." And this is coming from an Iranian, does not support what the government does to its own people. Here's from a person that wants hope and freedom, and yet Judge Tardast had been so effective in smearing Rouhani's reputation that even my Facebook friend was part of believing the deception. But you see, that's all they have, is this kind of philosophy, this way of answering the charge of self-defense. This is all the Iranian government has. They have nothing more. but lies. So Rouhani is a symbol of all Iranian women who fight to survive every single day of their life. They fight to keep their head above water and to do all they can to fight for their freedom. And today what I want you to take away from this reading is who Rouhani was. Rouhani was a girl who would not sacrifice her principles on the court of deceit. And she teaches every one of us a lesson in courage. She teaches us that even though the odds are against you, you fight to survive and stand on your principles, and you do not sacrifice them on the altar of convenience, even to save your own life. Rouhani refused to lie, but in one situation, when her sister's life was at stake, when she knew that they would try to kill her, she confessed to something that was untrue because she loved her sister. That was her sister. That was her own sibling. And it tore her soul into pieces to say something that wasn't true. But I believe that Rouhani was never a liar. And she was a woman of great principle and conviction. And as you think about today and what this book means, I hope you take away from this book the fact that you, through the pages of my book, have met an extraordinary, extraordinary human being, a human being of great character. What a shame she puts on this government. What she said and did shows this government what they really are, the evil that they really are. She's with Jesus right now. And one day, her case will receive the utmost of justice from our just God of the universe. I want to say God bless you to everyone who joined me today on this very special reading. I will see you on the next Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible week. God bless you and goodbye.